comes from Isaiah chapter 65, verses 17 to 25. Behold, I will create new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create. For I will create Jerusalem to be a delight and its people a joy. I will rejoice over Jerusalem and take delight in my people. The sound of weeping and of crying will be heard in it no more. Never again will there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. He who dies at 100 will be thought a mere youth. He who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed. They will build houses and dwell in them. They will plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build houses and others live in them, or plant and others eat. For as the days of a tree, so will be the days of my people. My chosen ones will long enjoy the works of their hands. They will not toil in vain or bear children doomed to misfortune, for they will be a people blessed by the Lord, they and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are still speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb will feed together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox, but dust will be the serpent's food. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountains, says the Lord. May God bless to us that reading for this word. All of that will make sense. If you're over 100, well done. If you're under 100, you've still got some work to do, but that day's to come rather than in the next couple of weeks. Well, who knows? We're going to look at that in a bit more detail, and the next passage that we'll read in a moment after we've sung the next hymn, which you can remain seated for, because I don't really like you up and down all the time. Makes me feel dizzy. And that is, you're the Word of God the Father. Verses 5 to 19, and can be found on starting on page 1056 of the Church Bible. Some of his disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. But Jesus said, "As for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down." "Teacher," they asked, "when will these things happen? And what will be the sign that they are about to take place?" He replied, "Watch out that you are not deceived. For many will come in my name, claiming, 'I am he,' and 'the time is near.' Do not follow them. When you hear of wars and revolutions, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but the end will not come right away." Then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, famines, and pestilences in various places, and fearful events, and great signs from heaven. But before all this, they will lay hands on you and persecute you. They will deliver you to synagogues and prisons, and you will be brought before kings and governors, and all on account of my name. This will result in your being witnesses to, them. But make up your mind not to worry beforehand how you will defend yourselves. For I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or contradict. You will be betrayed even by parents, brothers, relatives, and friends, and they will put some of you to death. All men will hate you because of me, but not a hair of your head will perish. By standing firm, you will gain life." God bless to us that reading from his word. So you might be wondering why, in the middle of November, the lectionary readings, which we've just read two of them, are just so miserable. It's all about doom and gloom, really. And that's because next week is the last day of the church year, which is the Feast of Christ the King, which I'm not doing another breakfast, I'm telling you now. Feast of Christ the King. And that's all about how Christ is victorious. But we need to understand what Christ comes to come and win, essentially, for us to really get the idea that he's victorious. And then Advent is New Year's Day. Isn't that brilliant? We get two New Year's days if we're Christian. We get New Year's Day, which is the first day of Advent, which this year is on the 30th of November, just to mess up all Advent calendars. And then we get New Year's Day as well, where we get to have fish. So I'm told. And Rachel gets really upset because she doesn't like fish very much, but I insist. I'm cooking it, she eats it. That's all there is to it. So, but it's really trying to get us to understand. And then we go into Advent, which, as we all know, when we've actually done a proper Advent, is one of the gloomiest seasons in the entire church year. Because it's all about the now and the not yet and a coming judgment and, you know, just to cheer everyone up. Just in time for Christmas. Which means that if we've done Advent properly, Christmas is actually quite exciting because Christ has come in order to save us and rescue us. And isn't that great from all the doom and gloom that we've been talking about for about 6 weeks beforehand? There is even, I don't know how many of you will know this, but there is even a thing called Long Advent. Which if you are in certain churches in the world, you actually start Advent on Remembrance Sunday, and it's just full-on doom and gloom from that point onwards until you get to Christmas Day, and even then don't enjoy yourself. So we're looking at Jesus talking to the disciples outside of the temple. Now for Luke, we think that Luke is written post AD 70, okay? And the reason that we think Luke is written post AD 70 is because he seems to know an awful lot about the siege of Jerusalem and the sacking of the temple. He does kind of drop things into his text to talk about that. And he's not wrong. The siege of Jerusalem does indeed result in there not being a stone left of the temple, because the Romans get a little bit annoyed. So for those of you that don't know what happens in AD 70, the Israelites decide they're going to, or Israel decides it's going to revolt against the Romans, which is always a really clever idea. A tiny nation that isn't very well organized, revolting against the biggest empire on earth at that particular time, a major fighting machine. In fact, the only people that ever really got very far in beating the Romans was Boadicea or Boudica, depending on whether we're having a fancy name or not. So she did quite well, but ends up getting stuck in a rut, literally, in Watling Street. And the other is Hannibal. Hannibal and the Carthaginians come over the Alps on elephants. I don't know where he got elephants from for the Alps. I'd just love to see it if someone walks in and just like, yeah, so we're going to go over the Alps. Oh, yeah, we're going to go on the Alps, yeah. And we're going to take elephants. Can they ski? What use is an elephant going to be to me? But Hannibal gets all the way into Rome and he sacks Rome. I mean, wow, this is taking on the big fighting machine. Everyone else, not so much. They tend to get beaten up and deaded, really. And that's kind of what happens here. There is the siege of Jerusalem. They decide they're going to try and starve them out. And the siege of Jerusalem goes on for 2 years. And it gets so bad that the people inside Jerusalem resort to cannibalism in order to eat, which is pretty rough. And when the Romans come in, having been through the siege of Jerusalem, when the Romans break the siege, they decimate it. They literally burn the place to the ground. They take away anything of value as kind of a triumph, etc. This is why we think that the Dead Sea Scrolls are where they are as well, because there's a community that hide things. But that's what happens. And they don't just, they've had enough of these pesky Israelites, and they just destroy them. And the temple is flattened. There literally is not a stone left on top of one another. And so it's why, that's part of the reason we think that Luke has a pretty good idea of what's going on. Because he almost writes it in the past tense. But there you go. But I don't really want to talk about that. I want to talk about what Jesus is saying to his people. The first thing is I think Jesus is trying to get us to understand that things are going to be bad. And they will continue to be bad, but that doesn't mean that the end is nigh. I don't know how many of you have moved in Christian circles where people will tell you that, well, of course, the Lord is returning tomorrow, because, well, look at this. This sign is happening, and this sign is happening, and this sign is happening, and look at this. And there's wars, and there's rumors of wars. And I get a little bit frustrated when people do that. And that's not because for any other reason than I just wish they'd go and read the Bible. Because Jesus says, and I'll quote you because I feel like it, there will be wars. When you hear of wars and revolutions, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but the end will not come right away. He's not, that's verse 9. He's not messing around. And yet we still get people come up to us and go, oh yeah, well of course this means that Christ is returning tomorrow. Because this war is happening, and there's a plague, and there's a pestilence, and there's a famine. Yes, all of these things will happen. But it doesn't mean that Christ is returning. But what does mean Christ is returning is that the church is going to be persecuted. He says all of these things will happen. There'll be earthquakes, pestilences, famines in various places, and fearful events and great signs from heaven. But before all this, they will lay hands on you and persecute you. They will deliver you to synagogues and prisons, and you will be brought before kings and governors on all account of my name. So whilst we have our people telling us that the world is going to, you know, Jesus is returning tomorrow, I'm really sorry, it hasn't got bad enough. The wars and rumors of wars and famine and pestilence and earthquakes, they aren't anything, because the church is still free. It is here, grace. Okay, and as soon as the church stops being free here and in America, that's when I think we might be at the point where it's going to break. But the church isn't free across the globe, no. But there are parts where we can still preach the gospel in freedom. You look at what's going on in Nigeria, this thing that no one seems to want to report, which is absolutely horrendous. Over 1 million Christians have been massacred in Nigeria in the last 10 years by Boko Haram, who are an Islamist group. Churches have been burned to the ground with the people inside them. And yet, I seem to hear people in the West telling us that things are getting a bit bad, because someone has given them a dirty look because they talked about Jesus. Well, that's nothing in comparison to what's going on with the persecuted church in the world. But there's hope, because I don't want you to feel miserable. I try not to get you all walking out going, whoa, whoa, whoa. I try to get you to be up, you know, happy. So the positives are that Jesus isn't going to leave us to our own devices. Listen to what he says. You'll be handed over to synagogues and prison, and you'll be brought before kings and governors, and all on account of my name. This will result in your being witnesses to them. Wow. What a masterstroke. Okay? Because the people who you can't get to, the people who you can't get to hear the good news of Jesus Christ, because they're in positions of power and they're corrupting everybody and they're bullying everybody. Guess what? God's going to get you right in there. How exciting! I can see the joy on your faces. But how exciting, because God's breaking down barriers that we didn't think of. You know, we can pray for all sorts of areas, and I've used this so many times before, but do you know how the Berlin Wall fell down? It was interesting, Sandra said maybe we should build the Berlin Wall this morning. But do you know how the Berlin Wall fell down? This is absolutely fascinating. I only found this out a couple of years ago. Obviously, the Berlin Wall falls down because there's a big upswell of people turning up and going, we've had enough of this, and they basically kick the wall down. But that isn't actually the whole story. In East Germany, it was illegal to gather in groups of more than three. Okay? Because if you gather in groups of more than three, you're clearly plotting revolution. I don't know how you have a family bigger than three, but in gathering in groups of more than three, you're plotting a revolution. So this was banned. But what had been happening was, for about 6 months beforehand, the Christians in East Berlin were saying, we really ought to pray about this. And they had been gathering in small groups of three all over East Berlin. And then the week before, one of them said, we should just gather all together and see what happens. So all of these Christians turn up for a prayer meeting. And there is something like 15,000 of them. They've all been gathering in their little groups of three, but now they're all together. And there's 15,000 Christians having a prayer meeting. And do you know the night they decided to have it? It was the night the Berlin Wall came down. They're all praying that God would do something and that he would break away all of this nonsense, etc. And they prayed, Lord, will you just bring this wall down? Will you reunite us? Will you be glorified in this? Fantastic, isn't it? And then God goes, yes, and he says to them, leave your building. They are breaking the law. They are risking the Stasi turning up and imprisoning all of them, which has happened before, and probably shooting all of them. But there's not a single member of the Stasi anywhere to be seen. When they walk out and they walk towards the Berlin Wall, they also discover there's not a single soldier on the wall. So they knock it down. And that is how the Berlin Wall comes down. That is amazing. That's God moving. They didn't have to walk around it 7 days and blow trumpets. He'd done that one. What he did instead was he just got them together to pray, and he witnessed to it, and then suddenly everyone is pouring out of their homes, taking bits of wall and going, that's it, we're free, because the East German government had toppled. And we think God can't do anything. And we look at the state of our nation and we say, oh, if only God had moved. Well, I tell you what, maybe we just need, ow, that really hurt. Oh. It's okay. I did my knee in the back room. So, I did that once at Abbey, and we had a metal lectern, and I sliced my hand open across my thing. So I'm stood there going, ha! And I've got some tissues in there, and I've got, I'm gripping my tissue. There is blood literally dripping off it. And one person, after I'd finished the sermon, went, are you okay? I'm fine. Anyway, so perhaps we need to respond to what God's calling us to do. The biggest frustration I have, and I have really have shared this with you before, is that there are more Christians or more people that go to church on a Sunday in this country than are members of every political party in the country. And they get to run the place. Really great news. There are more people in this, there are more people who attend church on a Sunday in this country than watch EastEnders every week. And they're front page news when someone shoots one of them. There are more people who attend church on Sunday than watch Strictly. Praise God. I'm so pleased I'm not one of the people who watches Strictly. What's that? Oh, that's quite good. I like that. We'll keep that one in. Right. And what's the response of the Christians in the country? Oh, we're defeated. We even get people saying in this country that we're being persecuted. We're really not. We might not be liked, but we're not being persecuted. Let's not be daft. There is no one being rounded up at 2 o'clock in the morning taken off somewhere. We had a guy in Reading who was from Sri Lanka, and you wouldn't necessarily say that Sri Lanka is a place where you get persecuted, but it is. He walks out of his office one afternoon. He is picked up by the police. He is bundled into the back of a car, and a bag is put over his head. He is then taken, he's in Colombo, which is the capital city of Sri Lanka. He is then taken to somewhere where he is questioned, he is stripped, and he is beaten. All of it about what does he know about Christians, and is he prepared to deny Jesus? Will he deny Jesus? And he kept on saying, no, I'm not going to do it. So they give him a good kicking, they strip him completely of his clothes, then they bundle him into the back of a car, having put a hood back on him, bundle him into the back of a car, and he thinks, that's it, they're taking me to kill me. He is then pushed out at the side of the road and just left, about 5 miles outside of Colombo, completely naked. He then walks home, grateful he's alive. But at that particular point, his name's Satish, he's a lovely guy. At that particular point, he was given exactly what it says here. He was given the words to say, and he was a witness to the transforming power of Jesus Christ. He refused to deny him in front of other people, even under immense pressure. He refused to deny him. The point of this passage is not to say, isn't life dreadful? It's to remember Isaiah 65, that there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. That the difficulties that are happening now are going to be no more. But we just need to hold fast until Jesus comes again. and we need to stand true to what we believe in. Some people think that being a Christian means that you're a bit wet and woolly and a bit of a wimp. I would like to just introduce them to the persecuted church. And let's not forget, I was listening to something the other day about in this country. We've never had religious persecution in this country. Of course we have. We just did it to ourselves. You think about it. You think about what it was like to be a Baptist in the 1600s and the 1700s. It was illegal. In this church, probably not this one, but in this church, they're getting bricks thrown through the windows whilst the service is happening. They're having to employ a guard so that the preacher can preach without interruption and without being attacked. Now, please stay in your seat. Because we haven't got a guard anymore. But they're having to do that. You couldn't vote. You couldn't hold public office. You couldn't be in the armed forces. You couldn't go to university. You couldn't actually have an education other than the one the church provided for you. In Abbey, which was at that point just the Baptist church in Reading, they used to meet on in a boathouse on the Kennet and Avon Canal. And they had a rope bridge that went over the Kennet and Avon Canal. So that when the authorities came to the front door, they went out the back door, went over the rope bridge and picked it up and disappeared off into the night. In Bristol, a lady, I'm going to get her name wrong now, Dorothy Hazard. There you go, I've got her name right, that's good. In Bristol, Dorothy Hazard is imprisoned, partly because she can't keep her mouth shut and also because she threw mud at the king. But she's imprisoned and is so convicted that she needs to preach. She is stood at the window of her cell preaching to the people of Bristol, and about 2,000 of them turn up to hear her every Sunday until the jailers get fed up with her and let her go. And what are we asked to do as Christians today? We're asked, what did you do Sunday? And this seems to be one of the most complicated questions you can ask people. What did you do Sunday? Oh, well, I just potted around for a bit. Really? Did you go to church? I was having a conversation with a group of teenagers recently, Christian teenagers, and I said, would you invite your friends to church? Well, first of all, I said, do your friends know that you go to church? A lot of looking at our feet round about that point. Okay. And one of them went, yeah, well, mine do. Guess. Okay. Would you invite your friends to church? Do you ever talk to your friends about Jesus? They probably wouldn't be my friends anymore if I did. Well, you're making a massive assumption on their behalf, actually. They might be. They might go, that's nice. You might find out that some of them are. But they're too scared to talk about it. It's just it was a fascinating conversation. But I don't think it stops at teenagers. I think it goes well into our dotage, that we're not necessarily that forward, we're more backward than we are in coming forward. The point is, we're too worried about what we're going to have to say. We haven't come up with all the answers, but here's the great news: I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or contradict. I'll give you the words to say when you're stood in front of rulers and kings. I will step in, and you'll wonder where the words that have just come out of your mouth have actually come from. Really proud the other day, Samuel came home and he said, Dad, what? I've met another Christian. Wow, And I said, how did you find out they were a Christian? Well, we were in EB, which is, for those of you that don't know, ethics and beliefs. I always thought ethics was next to Kent. But ethics and beliefs. We were doing ethics and beliefs. And my friend, and I didn't know this, said that he goes to church on Sundays. And I went, oh, that's good. He said, now everyone knows I go to church on Sunday because of you. Oh, thanks. And I said, but there, and he said, but there was someone else. And you know the words that he used? I didn't feel like such a freak. Oh. And I said, Samuel, is there a Christian union at Hounsdown? And he went, yeah. Well, I guess they're all freaks as well, are they? He went, no. And I said, do you know how many people go to the Christian Union at Hounsdown? I don't know. So, but Samuel being Samuel, went away and found out. And he came back and he said, there are 73 of them, Dad. I said, well, maybe there's 73 freaks in the school. I don't know. Or perhaps you're not as alone as you thought you were. And there'll be others. Do you know there are at least four ministers' children that go to Hampstead? You know that? Because there's two of mine. Matt at Testwood, his boy goes there. And Hannah's just got a new best friend. An Anglican guy's come into somewhere in Tottenham, and his son's going. It's at least four. You know, we're infiltrating everywhere. But the point is that actually give us the words to say. Toby, when he was doing his, I was really proud of Toby for this. He had to do a speech for English, and you'd have to stand up and deliver this speech. I'm so pleased they didn't ask me to do that when I was a kid, because they wouldn't have got much. But you have to do this speech. I said, "Oh, what are you doing your speech on?" He said, "Religious persecution and why it's difficult to be a Christian." Wow. How did the speech go? Yeah, it was really good. What did you say in it? I told him the gospel. Okay. Brilliant. And I said, and how did your friends react? Well, they said it was really cool. There you go. What does it say? For I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries were able to resist or contradict. God's moving and God's doing this. Now, you can go and read Revelation as a tick list. You can read Isaiah as a tick list. These things must happen. You can go and read Daniel, if you like, as another tick list and go, this must happen, and you've got to have something with feet of clay and all the rest of it. You can do all of that, or you can say, actually, the most important thing is I witness to Christ. That's my job. I will witness to the love that he's shown me. I will witness to the transforming power that he has, the way that he's taken me from where I am to where I am, from where I was to where I am. And I will finish, you'll be so pleased to hear, with this wonderful quote that comes from a William Barclay commentary. And it's a labourer, and he'd been an alcoholic. And he'd come to know Jesus, and he'd stopped drinking, etc. And he's on the building site, and his mates are all taking the mick, and etc. There's, I think it's called banter. And he says, they say to him, look, you, especially you, you can't believe that Jesus turned water into wine. And he said, I don't know if 2,000 years ago Jesus turned water into wine. But I do know this, that in my house he's turned beer into furniture. The transforming power of Jesus. Did that man know where those words were coming from? Probably not. Did God give him the words to say at the right time? Absolutely. Did he end up in a commentary, which is basically where everyone gets their illustrations from? Absolutely. And we can be encouraged by it because God's given us that encouragement. Things are going to get tough. Okay, but they always have been. That's the message that Jesus is giving. But at the point where they come for you and they ask you, will you stand for me? Will you declare me? What are you going to do? Are you going to run away and hide? Or are you going to allow the Spirit to take over and speak the words that he gives you to speak in front of kings and governors and synagogues and all the rest of it?